Welcome to Avery Ventures Podcast. I'm Ryan Avery.
And I'm Tanya Avery.
We're down here in Boise. We're with the Dione Amuchastegui, which I've been told by Dione is Amuchastegui is Basque.
Yep.
And Basques are really close to Neanderthals.
Very close.
Do you want to explain that? You want to explain yourself on that?
Well, we lived in a remote mountainous region of Spain, and Neanderthals moved in, and everybody else was doing their own thing, crossbreeding, keeping that genetic diversity, and we just stayed Neanderthal.
All right. So it's like the Flintstones, eras, you know, hairy feet.
Essentially.
Blocks.
Yeah.
Huh. Fred Flintstone did not have hairy feet.
Oh, how do you know?
I watched the cartoon.
Well, I've seen Dione's car. It doesn't look like Flintstone's car.
No.
Floor's removable.
Floor's removable. Use your blocky feet for the brakes.
Yep.
We had Dione on a while back. If you don't know about Dione, he is a public land mule deer assassin. Would you concur with that?
I don't know about assassin. I think assassins are stealthy and have nifty gear and trinkets. And I feel like a clumsy oaf who just hangs around in the woods long enough to get lucky.
Yeah, we just covered he was a Neanderthal.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, even Neanderthals got lucky sometimes. He's out there a lot, so he's going to get lucky.
Exactly.
Well, then that's not luck.
I'm playing the odds.
I did talk to you halfway through the season. I want to bring this story up that you said you may be going in a little too far.
Going in a little too far?
Yeah, you said you went in once scouting and it was way too damn far.
Yeah, I just really dilute your ability to be effective if you're overdoing yourself. I was able to make it to this spot, but I really wasn't able to get in there regularly and scout it just because it was too much of a job. There was a couple times where I'd leave my house in the evening. I got a new baby, so it's kind of hard to get away, but I'd leave my house 7-8 o'clock in the evening and I'd start making my way in there, and I would be moving the entire night trying to work my way in there, and it gets light around 6 o'clock that time of year. You know, I wouldn't be getting in there till 4:35 o'clock in the morning, and I was traveling the whole time. You know,
so you're leaving after work, driving there, and then hiking all night.
Yep. And then I would scout for 3 or 4 hours and turn around and come home because, you know, newborn baby, my wife's tired too. So, I was wearing myself ragged. Just way too much work, way too much drive time. And, there's an absolutely giant buck in there is why I was going. But, it was too far for me to go be effective in.
So from Dione pre-baby to Dione now.
I'd have lived on that deer.
And people keep saying, I hear that a lot. Oh, you know, babies or, you know, life doesn't get in the way, but it does in fact get in the way.
Yeah. And I still, you know, I run myself absolutely ragged trying to still do everything I did. And I can to a lesser extent, but I just have to accept that, you know, I don't have the time availability to go out and be as effective as I used to. So I have to kind of fall back on past knowledge. And then I also have to be more reasonable about what places I'm going to try and go and scout, what places I'm going to go and try and hunt. Cause some of them just aren't feasible at this point in my life.
Gotcha.
Well, I think that's, you know, I mean, as life happens, I think that happens to a lot of people. So it seems like the message is go out while you're young and you're single and learn everything you can because you're going to need to pull from that knowledge later in life when you don't have as much time commitments.
Definitely. And, you know, I think everybody can break away for a day. I was traveling, God, what was it, 8-9 hours it would take me from my house to get into this spot. You know, I had a like 3-4 hour drive and then pretty significant hike. And, you know, I was still going scouting. I was making 1-day trips. I was doing everything I could to get out. And I ended up, benefiting from that still, even though I know a lot of the areas I hunt pretty well. People try and make excuses. They just can't do it. And I was running myself pretty ragged through the week, trying to get the lawn mowed, get the house clean, do all the things I needed to do to be a good husband and father, and then, work out whatever window of time I could. And I was still making it out and scouting. I wasn't doing it 3 days every weekend.
So you just adapted
because
a lot of people, it's easy to make excuses.
Yeah.
I mean, we all do it like, oh, I just don't have time. But if you try hard enough, I think you can carve out the time you need to.
Yeah.
To some extent.
You got to want it.
Yeah. If you listen to, you know, Robbie Denning or you that are pretty much one species guys, that they've made that sacrifice. There's things I'm sure that you sacrificed that sure you want. Mm-hmm. You know, Robbie said he wanted a new truck, but he was driving around in 19, I don't know how old that Toyota was, but it was from the 80s forever,
1914,
because he's making those sacrifices. And it seems like it's with you guys. And I don't know what the mule deer, they're just a cult following bunch of guys, but their mantra is, you know, we do have to make sacrifices to make this happen.
Oh, definitely. And definitely. I had a lot of other hobbies. I had a lot of other interests before I got bit bad by the mule deer bug. And I gave up all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't do hardly any of the other things. I used to bow fish a ton. I used to go hiking a lot more, do like just camping trips type stuff, not scouting trips. Now everything's a scouting trip. Like, anytime I go anywhere, I'm looking for deer. Yeah, I had a lot of other hobbies and interests. I really enjoyed bow hunting elk at one phase of my life. And then I, you know, came back to sanity. But
well, I think the caveat is your wife, you said, is a very patient woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Robbie's wife, because I know he spends a ton of time away from home. And if you don't have a good working relationship, I don't think that you can make that happen.
Well, and, you know, I don't know Robbie's wife at all, and I don't know anything about their relationship, but I can guarantee you that he goes to great efforts to make sure that she's happy and has her things too. And,
right.
And you know, doesn't just make it to where it's like, oh, well, see you later. I'm gone for the weekend. Her needs are met before he leaves.
And that's a lot of things I don't think a lot of guys understand, because I've had men approach me at shows and say, how do I convince my wife to let me go hunting as much as Ryan goes hunting? And I was like, well, you're already starting off on the wrong foot, because you do not get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't understand apparently give and take in a relationship, because you're already trying to figure out how to manipulate your wife into getting to do what you want to do. So I think it's a big, huge sacrifice for both people. And you have to have a mutual understanding and a good relationship to make it happen.
And I'm not saying that there isn't a little bit of resentment come the end of hunting season.
Absolutely.
I run it for all I can get, but you know, I definitely do try and be conscious and aware that, you know, she's got needs and they need to be met.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think one thing that never gets, cause we get asked this question a lot, is we're not deadbeat husbands or deadbeat dads. You know, the kids don't need diapers. You know, we're providing. And then hunting is secondary. We don't just say, all right, I'm out of here. It's too bad we don't have no power on.
Yeah.
Oh, do you want to go there? Because one time you did leave when the furnace was broken.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a little different. It was going to get fixed. I just wasn't there when it got fixed.
Repairman on the way, but I'm like, are you serious? We don't have heat.
Well, what I'm saying is, we don't just say, we don't have money for food, but I'm going hunting for 4 weeks. You know, it doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, and I do a lot of side work, and I do a lot of other things to make money. I don't try to take any money out of my regular paycheck to pay for hunting stuff. And you know, I don't have the nicest gear all the time. I'd love to have all new clothes. I'd love to have a lot of different stuff, but you know, I don't take any of those resources away from my family.
Yeah. Well, that's a big thing, is you, even though you don't have the top end of everything, you still get out there, you still get it done. And that's what a lot of people get stuck on, is trying to get exactly the right equipment they think they need before they're willing to go out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't end up going out because they never get to that, like, you know, pot of gold in gear.
And, you know, I'm grateful. I really dove into backcountry hunting in 2011, and I'm the kind of person who gets analysis paralysis. I overthink things too much. And
Rockside loves you.
when I started doing it, there wasn't anything. Like, there was very, very minimal backcountry hunting gear out there. I mean, there's starting to be some clothes. I don't think Kuyu was even a company then.
I think it started that year.
Yeah. So, you know, hardly any of this stuff that people obsess over existed. I bought all my stuff off of Craigslist. It wasn't even nice stuff off Craigslist. It was junk off of Craigslist, because that's what I could afford at the time. And you know, I didn't know any different. There wasn't any other information out there. So, you know, I got that trial by fire, and I learned what it felt like to be miserable. So I do really appreciate the nicer things we have now, but I learned that they're not always necessary. You know, there's things I have now that I think a lot of my success can be attributed to, but mm-hmm. I don't think that there's anything. I could still walk into Walmart, buy all my hunting gear, and kill a big deer.
Right. Oh, I agree with that. And Robbie, it's funny how you guys parallel Robbie, because when I first met Robbie, man, he was wearing the old tree bark shirt with a hole in the pocket with toilet paper hanging out of it. And I always picture him, and he's like, I don't care what I have, I'm going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But on that note, with you talking about gear, and we are gear junkies, as you know,
gear is nice.
Yeah. What is it? What if you're an aspiring mule deer hunter, and you want that one thing, what is that one thing, good thing a mule deer hunter has to have?
Well, I mean, it depends on if you're starting with absolutely nothing or if you've got, you know, basics, rifle, rangefinder, binoculars. Rangefinders are huge. I would say a rangefinder is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, because it just opens up your world to what you can shoot. But binoculars, I could live without a spotting scope, but I want to have the best binoculars I can afford no matter what. And gotcha. Then, you know, the thing that I always think is the most underrated thing is gas for your truck. and then weekends to burn it.
I can't argue with that. If you can't. So do you think as a mule deer hunter that your success is solely on your scouting?
I don't think it's solely on my scouting. I think at this point I've got a lot of base knowledge to fall back on. You know, like my Colorado trip this year, I'd never been there before. I've some great friends who gave me a lot of pointers about the area. And that was huge, but things were way different. You know, they got early snow and, third season just was not a typical third season from what I hear. And I'd never been there, so I have nothing to base that off of. And I wasn't finding deer where we were expecting to find deer. And, you know, I was driving back and forth through town from where we were car camped. And I just kept driving by this spot. I'm like, man, that looks like a place from Idaho where I've seen deer before. And I don't see anybody out there. It's public land. It's my last day. I went and checked it out. And sure enough, I found the biggest buck I saw the whole time I was there, you know? So I fell back on past knowledge, even though I'd never scouted it before. But most of that past knowledge I have comes from scouting, you know, cause we get such a limited window to hunt. You know, if you're basing everything, you know, off of that limited window of hunting season, you don't have a whole picture. Cause there's a lot of time of year where deer are way more visible, even in the area that they're going to be in during hunting season. And you can learn 10 times as much in a day that time of year as you can in a day during hunting season.
So that falls back into getting into the woods and yep. having prior knowledge and like a gut feeling that yeah. some, and so often I'm like, somebody could ask me, why are you staying here this extra time? And it's like, I don't know. I can't explain that. And I hear that from you guys also is cause I'm more on the elk side, but it's like, there should be something here in my previous experiences. So I'm going to stay that extra 2 hours. And sure enough, something might walk out or get up out of its bed and move a little bit. And then boom, there it is.
Yeah. And it happens fast. I mean, it, you know, the drudgery of being unsuccessful lasts a long time. And then that one instant of where things go right can happen instantly. So, you know, you have to be aware that there's going to be more bad times than good. And you have to endure those and you have to keep working at it.
Yes. And I bring this up to Tanya all the time and I don't know if she disagrees with me, but there has to be a little suckiness to be memorable.
Yeah. You wouldn't appreciate it if it was easy.
Absolutely.
Well, in all fairness, you don't say a little sucky. It's you say you have to endure the suck, and the more it sucks, the better your memory of it will be.
It is.
Some crap like that. And I'm like, you know, I don't know that I agree with that. I understand, you know, you have to know good from bad, and that makes your experiences more appreciated when they're good. I think that's true in life. You know, when you're not, you know, young and poor, if you've never been young and poor, you'll never appreciate, you know, being not poor, you know, when you get to actually making money in your life and things like that. But so I get the logic in there, but I'm not loving it when I'm out there freezing my ass off.
Yeah. What was the, I think it was in the Darren Cooper podcast you guys did. It was not secondhand appreciation, but their secondhand.
I remember. I don't know how they phrased that, but I do remember.
Yeah.
Darren, I don't know if it was mine or Darren's explaining that, but it's, yeah.
On his sheep hunt.
There's firsthand and there's like secondhand fun.
Yeah.
Is that the, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so true. And like you, you're not an elk guy, but you remember every one of probably those elk packouts because they sucked.
Yep.
And it's not, I'm not saying you enjoyed the process, but you damn sure remember the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's true. I get the logic, but you know, sometimes when you're freezing your ass off or, you know, like
certain hunts aren't everybody's cup of tea too.
No, they're not.
Yeah. I don't know. I just enjoy, you're not always going to be warm. It's not always going to be fun. And you're going to think, why the hell did I do this? And those are the hunts that I fall back to in my memory all the time. Mm. And I know you've been there.
I've had some miserable hunts.
Yeah, I listened to your podcast a couple of weeks ago that we did at the end talking about pepperoni sticks. You just have a pocket full of pepperoni sticks and roll out.
Oh, yeah. And you know, It's funny that the more and more that I get obsessed with deer, the less and less I realize that I'm miserable. So right. I just, your blinders go up to it, and it's like I'm so hyper focused on my goal that I'm numb to everything else.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So on your Idaho deer hunt this year, kind of take us through. You found a deer, a really nice deer. You showed us a picture of the deer. You didn't get to put your tag on that deer. Take us through you finding that deer, not finding that deer, keeping the faith in that unit, and still taking a quality deer.
Yeah, so I was actually with my friend Carl Blanchard, and we spotted this group of deer super long ways off, and just kept looking at them, and we took some really crappy pictures of them, and got to looking at it. It's like, man, that one, the frame on it looks like it's 3 foot wide. And we got another look at it. It's like, holy crap, that's probably one of the biggest deer I've ever seen in my life. And that was about the extent of it. We never got the absolute best look at it that day. We could tell it had a little bit of extra trash going on and an absolutely giant typical frame. And we'd scouted some other deer. And this is that place I was talking about earlier where it was just too stupid deep. And, okay, well, Carl's,
this is the one you said is like 7 miles in and you're killing yourself to get there and out.
Oh, like 14 miles.
Oh, just double seven. Let's just go 14 one way or round trip.
One way.
Holy shit, Dione.
Yeah. I mean, it was good traveling stuff. So you could move pretty fast, but, yeah, there's no real fast, easy way. I mean, it was probably, I think I said it was eight. It was probably more like 10 or 11 hours to get in there. It's a blur now because I didn't sleep much that time of year.
But. You're walking that in the dark.
Yeah.
So, that's impressive.
Yeah. So, you know, and I told myself, I'm like, okay, I know I'm getting really limited windows of time to go scout this, but I have to go find that deer.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back in, I think I went back in three more times, and I found some other really nice bucks, but I didn't see that deer. And
on the scouting thing, just to people's general knowledge, when do you start seriously scouting?
So I'll get pretty aggressive in like June looking for country, not so much trying to pick out a specific deer. And then through July, I'll start to focus more on, okay, let's try and find actual individual deer, you know, starting later in July. Before that, I'm just trying to find habitat, try and find good areas. And then, August, I'm really heavily looking for a deer. I'm falling back on those areas that I'd already scouted earlier in the year, trying to pick what looked the best, and then from there trying to find the deer. And if I find a great deer early, I'm just going to try and stay on him and learn everything I can about him. You know, like that deer I killed in 2016, I watched him for 2 months, and I knew, I think I knew more about that deer than I did about my wife that summer.
So you spotted the deer, you went in three times. On those three times, did you ever find him again?
Never saw him.
All right, take us through the rest of that.
So from there, I had seen quite a few other deer. You know, I wasn't traveling in there at night every time. And I knew the area from past experience also. So I knew there was good deer pretty much all over the area. And I ended up starting out my season on a different area from where I ended up killing. And there was a buck in there that was probably high 170s, maybe 180, giant backs, good frame. Just a really, really nice buck. He wasn't anything that was like, you know, Robbie Denning legend status, but
let's get real here.
He was a deer I'd have been really happy with. And that deer lived on one part of a hillside where he was just not killable. You know, I could glass it from across the canyon, but it was mixed burn and live timber. And if he's on that face of that hill, he can't be killed. You know, I'd watched him for 3 days in a row, and that deer would not move off that hill. And I'm like, okay, well, I know that deer's there, but wife's yelling at me. I got to get home. Like, tomorrow's my last day to hunt. I don't want to sit here and watch that deer on that hillside again, because I can't do anything about it. I'll see him, but I'm not going to be able to kill him. So I'm like, okay, well, I've got another area where I'd seen some other deer. It was actually the very first area I'd scouted that year, and I saw a group of like 11 bucks. And one of them was a pretty good buck. And while I was in there with Carl, we actually saw a couple bucks out of that group that were, you know, pretty considerable deer. They were for sure 170 inch deer, and that's what I aim to kill.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back in there, and I was looking, you know, directly in the area where Carl had actually seen that deer, and I was just creeping my way along because I gotten there a little bit late for the glassing session. So, you know, I told myself I've got this maybe quarter mile, half mile window that I'm going to try and look in and just find every deer that's in there today. So I was glassing around 15, 20 minutes, and then I'd move, you know, 20 yards. And I haven't spent a ton of time on this ridge, so I didn't have dedicated glassing points that I knew I could just go to. So I'm very, very slowly working my way through and just being methodical and glassing. And I'm glassing down into a little timber pocket on this ridge line, and I can just barely make out what looks like a tree that's tipped over and has something that looks off behind the tree. So, and it's all shadowed, and I can make out what looks like an ear, and it's very obscured, but I just keep looking at it. And I sat there for about a half hour just watching that spot, and sure enough, saw an ear move, and then it turned its head, and I could make out antlers through the branches of this downed tree. And it looked like it had a ton of mass. That's all I could really tell. And I moved around, got into a different position where I thought I'd be able to shoot from, and I couldn't find the deer. You know, I knew he was still there. It's just really, really thick. So I just kept looking at it and looking around, and I moved another 20 yards down the hill and still couldn't see it. And I started glassing around. I'm like, okay, maybe the deer got up, maybe moved around, start glassing ancillary areas just around there, and ended up finding what I now believe is a different deer. The deer I ended up killing, a little bit smaller, because I saw the other deer after the fact, but you know, I find this deer, he's bedded, facing straight on, 420 yards away. Man, I can paste him right here. So set up my camera, got through the spotting scope, forgot to hit record like I typically do.
That happens more often than you think.
Yeah. So I've set up the camera on deer that I was into. Well, I killed all of the three I've done it on, but I've only hit record one time. So I'm 2 for 3 on not hitting record, but so this deer's bedded head on, and he keeps dipping his head down. So I had to sit there forever for he'd finally move his head to where I could get a good shot on him. But yeah, I just smeared him.
So, nice. I didn't know a knot six would shoot that far.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually, my big wide buck, that's my profile picture on Instagram, is 32 inches wide. I shot him. He was head on at 570.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Well, that was that burger failure we've talked about on Rock Slide, where, you know, by the grace of God, I hit that deer in the heart, but I pulled that bullet out of the hind quarter, and it looks like someone smashed it in a vise sideways.
Yeah, and I am a burger fan, but that is a failure. In that run of whatever they did is a failure. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
I want to ask a quick question before you guys move on. We've talked about this before, but you said that you were glassing up an area that you said just looked unusual. And that was a tip that Ryan had given me a couple of years back when I'm glassing, because people just get kind of focused on looking for deer. But I think that what a good tip is like you said, is something doesn't look right in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So touch on that, what you mean by that.
We all have our own perspective of what we think deer country is supposed to look like, and it's usually not right. You know, every
I agree.
Every book you read has giant Wyoming basins that look just wide open, and they're grassy, and there might be a strip of brush running down through it. And if that's what you think big bucks live in, you're missing most of the picture. You know, if you live in that area, that's awesome. Like you've got a great playbook on how to find deer, but I've spent enough time watching them now that I've realized I need to watch what the deer are doing, and whatever they seem to like is what I need to look for. And you'll have big swaths of area that look pretty similar, and then you'll find something that stands out, and you know, that may be the thing that those deer are looking for, and you just got to try and key in on those things. So,
and that comes from lots of time in the field.
Yep.
But in the thing that I was thinking Tanya was hitting on is we don't look for whole animals.
Mm-mm.
We look for pieces of animals.
Yeah.
Like you said, the ear, what you tuned in on was the ear. Not, I mean, I think what a lot of people do when they're glassing, especially when they first start out, is they're looking for whole animals or racks, you know, like a head with the rack.
Yeah.
They're not looking for like one piece of antler or an ear or, yeah, you know, just like that one piece that will stand out if you have a lot of experience.
And like it or don't, it takes a lot of training to get your brain to identify those as a deer. Like, you know, we get trained to see certain things. Like, people recognize the shape of a stop sign, and even if it's dark out and they can't see it, they know it's a stop sign.
Right.
You know, your brain builds a pattern of, okay, this piece belongs to this thing, and then it fills in the rest of the picture. And that's not something that you can just go out and do. You know, I've actually got fairly poor vision. I'm not like just deer spotter God. I can't just go out there and pick deer off of the hillside without putting my binoculars up and actually working at it. But I've done it long enough now that, and I can recognize that from the time I started to where I'm at now, I am more able to discern what is a deer out of an obscured image than I've ever been. And that's just from doing it. That's practice. It's training yourself. You know, mm-hmm. you can train yourself to be better at these things.
Right.
So. And it's a perishable skill. Cause when you start every year, you're kind of, to me anyways, I know I miss deer or elk.
Oh, absolutely.
Because my mindset's not there, and it's like my eyes aren't there yet. And then the more I get in the woods, the more I start thinking, yep, I can spot this deer. I spotted that deer. And I was like, did I miss that one last time?
Well, so. And it's like, it's great training going through the summer, cause they're red. I mean, they're real easy to spot, but you're still building up those skills. And I feel like come hunting season, I'd be hard pressed to, well, I feel like I'd be hard pressed. I know I miss deer, but I feel like I catch most of them now, which you never can. But I always go out there with the mindset that I'm going to try and find every deer on the hill, and I'll be there as long as it takes to do it.
Right. And what you said about those high basins, if you take northern Idaho just to southern Idaho or even central Idaho, all three of those are totally different microclimates of how deer habitat is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're scouting one way there and looking for deer, you're not going to have the success. If you do North Idaho and you came down to Southern Idaho, it'll blow your mind because there's just so much more open country. So.
Yeah, and it's deceptive too, because you think sometimes the more open it is, the easier it'll be. But there's some country I've hunted in the past that seems like it's really open, but there's folds in those hills that you just cannot perceive. You don't know they're there till you've walked on top of them, and the deer can hide in them very well.
The sagebrush is so much taller than it looks.
Yeah, in a lot of places it is. Mm-hmm. You know, there's 7-8 foot high sagebrush out there.
Yeah, that's one thing that kind of messed with me when I first started hunting down in the South is like, oh, it just looks like you can just walk right up this hill in like 10 minutes. Well, that's not true. And then once you get up to like the brush, it's like, you know, as tall as you are. And you're like, well, no wonder I'm not seeing anything. It's hiding. They're all hiding in this, you know.
Yeah.
Aspens or sagebrush.
Yeah, it can be really deceptive. And that's part of why you have to look at a lot of different stuff and walk through a lot of different stuff, because you look at a lot of places on Google Earth and you think, oh man, it's just a big grassy hillside, and you get there and the whole thing's ceanothus. Like, you've got to teach yourself how to appreciate things from the other side of the hill or from wherever Absolutely. You're at. You know, if you don't have the perspective to appreciate what's over there, you're going to miss stuff.
So I'm a little confused on you found this 200 inch sized deer and you didn't go after him opening day. I'm confused.
So I didn't have enough information on that deer to feel like it was my best option. I had other deer found, and you know, it was just stupid deep. It was biting off too much. And
that's saying a lot from a Neanderthal. Just too far.
Well, I just knew if I tried to go after that deer, I was diluting my resources too much to potentially be effective on anything else. And I'd seen him once. I hindsight being 2020, I should have gone after that deer, because I know he was still in that area. You know, he was within a mile of where I saw him. But you know, things as they are, you make decisions in the moment, and you don't always make the right one. You know, I feel deep down in my gut that if I had found that deer the year before I had a kid, I would have killed that deer. I'm very confident in myself when I find a deer, and maybe falsely so, but if I find a deer once, I really like my odds of finding them again and killing them.
This was actually a question after we did the last one, and I never really got back to it, because most people, they don't argue this, but I hear this all the time, is you're finding deer in July,
mm-hmm.
and you're hunting them for the most part in like around 10th, first, mid October.
Yeah.
Those deer in your history they're not moving that far.
Not always, no.
Yeah, but, that's what I was going to ask. They don't really migrate after you see them in the summer.
Well, I'm not hunting high country. you know, it's high. I mean, but I'm not hunting giant wide open basins.
Right.
I'm hunting thicker, heavy cover country where they have no reason to move. There's plenty of late fall feed. There's plenty of cover. They're already comfortable there. So it's the kind of place they would push to if they were a high country buck. So I'm already hunting the places that those deer want to be that time of year.
So they're residents to that area pretty much. They're not mm-hmm. passing through.
Yeah.
That's interesting that you, so if what's your, and we kind of touched on this last time, but your strategy is you definitely have to move and find little windows to glass through to find.
Absolutely.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then it can be frustrating because there, you might want to move 10 yards over and you'd have the perfect angle, but there's a tree in your way. So you work with what you have and you have to just exhaust that resource till you absolutely know that you've seen everything on that hill. And you have to wait for those deer to move because honestly, a lot of times they might be at an angle or might be obscured by something. And you know, I truly believe to be able to appreciate what's on one reasonably sized hillside, I have to spend 3 days watching it.
Wow. Cause you're in the summer and they have very small windows of movement.
Yeah. I mean, earlier it gets, the less time it takes, but that buck I watched for 2 months in 2016, I was going in there every other weekend for 3 days and I'd be there for 3 days. And there was a couple weekends I saw him once.
So my question would be, so if they're not really migrating,
mm-hmm.
why are you needing to go back every weekend to watch just to see if they consistently stay there week through week?
Yeah, to see if they stick around and also learn their patterns, learn their habits. And, you know, when fall does come, those deer do change. But if I know that this buck likes to hang out on this part of the hill, even if he is a lot more reclusive and doesn't like to get out as much and doesn't move as much, that's where that deer's probably going to be. You know, I learned very well that year that even within a group of deer, you'd have a bachelor group of bucks and it seems like they're all living in the same area. You think they're all doing the same things. They all have their core area and they're different. You know, it's like that diagram where you have a bunch of different circles and they overlap in the middle. That's the area where you're primarily going to be seeing them. And that's, you know, that's the picture that most people get. But if you watch them long enough, you realize that, okay, this deer likes to hang out over here more. This deer likes to hang out over here more. And that's where they overlap.
Gotcha.
You know, so
that makes a lot of sense.
It was a good learning experience for me. And knowing what I know now, I probably won't spend that much time watching one deer, but I'm glad that I did.
In reality, you're hunting less pressured deer because there's not, seems like everybody's just blasting up to those basins, you mm-hmm. know, those big alpine-y looking basins. And obviously they're blowing right past quality deer.
Yeah. That's the thing that just keeps getting reinforced for me every year. Cause I scout different areas. I try and hunt different units regularly. I just love scouting. I love getting into different places and it's surprising how many big deer there are all over the place. And I think a lot of people lose sight of the fact that, you know, we have great general units across almost all of Idaho. I firmly believe there's 180 inch buck in every unit in the state. And I think the same goes for Oregon and the same goes for Montana and, you know, maybe not 180 inch buck, but I think there's good deer almost everywhere a guy could hunt if he knows what to do and he's willing to put the work in to find them.
Yeah. I mean, look at that Colorado deer we talked about. How does a deer that's 340 whatever inches hide like that? And you made good points.
I think he's somewhere where people weren't looking for him. You know, I don't know hardly anything about that deer, but my speculation would be that he's not in a premier unit.
He was a 1-point draw unit.
Yeah. So.
Well, as Robbie says, is those deer are the smart ones. And they know how to hide better.
Yeah.
And I think he's right. Because you know what? I mean, he lived that long. It'd be interesting to see if they tooth aged him.
I would imagine they did.
I'd hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too, because I'll be curious to see how old he is. You know, how long he's actually been able to evade.
Or he just had great genetics and he's 3.5.
That's
no, I mean, that would be interesting to know, because that would be kind of cool to find out.
That's one of the other things I've gotten a better appreciation for in the last few years is that not all deer get big. You know, everybody likes to think, oh, that deer just needs another year. Like, that deer's already really old. You see the brisket hanging off the front of that thing?
It's funny. But,
you know, yeah. Not all deer get big. And in the areas I spend most of my time, I would say the average buck tops out at 160. So you really do have to look over a lot of deer, and it really does take something exceptional to make a deer like that happen.
You're so right. got a big old brisket, big old belly. Oh, that deer just needs a few more years. It'll be dead in a few more years.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the best bucks I saw this year, probably a high 170s buck, just an awesome deer. His main beam, he's going to blow up. Big deer, probably 28 inches wide, super long main beams. And one of them actually starts to drop down at the end. And he's got a little drop time that's starting. But you could tell he was a little itty bitty bodied deer. And then there's this 140 inch buck that's living in the same basin. That's all just kind of crabby looking. And he's got a ton of mass and a bunch of little stickers coming off, but he is the least impressive big buck, but he's got that giant brisket hanging off of him. His ass ends half again wider than that little buck. And I was filming these deer. And actually while I was filming the younger, bigger buck, that other like 140 class buck walks up. This deer's bedded down in his bed, takes his foot, kicks him.
No way.
The little big buck gets up out of his bed. The other guy kicks his bed out and lays down in it. So he was definitely the dominant deer in that basin.
Yeah. Right.
But it doesn't mean his rack's big.
No, that's, and it's so true. I hear that all the time. And I mean, I'm not the expert on mule deer, but I can look at an animal and think that dude's got some age, and you're right. Genetics plays a big key. Obviously nutrition does too.
And I'm no expert either. I did your deal on Rock Slide last year where it was guess the age, and I was just as wrong as everybody else.
Yeah. And you look at deer, just like Robbie, he goes, I'm wrong more than I'm right. And yeah, it's just so hard.
But there's a line where you can tell. It's like, okay, this is a young deer or this is an old deer. I think it's really hard to say what year it is, but you know,
yeah,
it's pretty hard to argue body size.
Well, you are within a year of every deer we had. You weren't like, you were saying he was 6.5 and he was 3.5. You know, you were within a year.
Yeah, my total was way off though, and you were going off totally.
Yeah.
That's right. You can look at a deer and see that it has age.
Yeah.
Like you look at a dog and you can tell, you know, a younger dog from an older dog just by, you know, the face.
Definitely.
The coloring.
And especially if you've got two that are next to each other, you can say, okay, this one's obviously bigger. This one's obviously not, you know.
So I want to talk about the big news. The big news in Dione's hunting world. He's leaving the venerable
oh yeah, the venerable 30-06.
And you're going to this new sexy pretty whiz bang 6.5 PRC.
Yeah.
Why the move?
So I still have nothing but love for the 06. As I've extended my ranges and I want to be proficient at further. Wind drift is the enemy of long range. I just want to be more immune to that. I want to have less to think about, and it's pretty hard to argue that a slippery bullet going really fast is not going to have less wind drift.
So what are you going to?
6.5 PRC. 6.5.
Tell us about it. Who's making it? What's the build? What's
so
on it?
It's an axial precision rifle, and I've actually got, I've talked Drew over there into putting a Hell's Canyon Armory barrel on it for me, because I've had great luck with that, and I'm good friends with Mike Johnson from up there.
Going with a ginger barrel.
The ginger, Redbeard barrel.
Is that an actual name of the barrel?
Because if it's not, it should be. And I'm using one of the Axial Precision carbon fiber stocks and just going with their action. It's got an integral recoil lug on it, and it's the whole thing's just fantastically designed. It's got a lot of thought going into every piece of it. So it's not something where someone just took an action off the shelf and took a barrel and you know, threaded it up and stuck them together. Every piece on it was made to work with all the other pieces.
Did you say trigger?
What's that?
You're going with the axial precision stock and the action?
And then I think he's putting a trigger tech on there for me. So that's what I want to go with. And then I'm going to go with a Bushnell 4.5-18, the Elite. I think it's the LRTS. LRTS or LRHS, I always mix those up. Making the big jump over to Mills this year.
So, oh lordy.
Yeah, I'm going to be a loss. I'll probably miss everything I shoot at.
I highly doubt that. You know, it's just truthfully, everybody argues that's just a different angular measurement.
Yeah.
Once you do it for a little bit, you'll get the hang of it, but
just as long as you remember that.
Yeah.
I like it because in my mind, I shot minutes forever and I've been slightly moving to I can remember those lower numbers easier. So when I get to 500 yards, I know it should be around this, or I get to 800 yards, it should be around this, to where I'm in mills, it may be, you know, 2.5 mills, where it's in minutes, it's like 19 minutes.
Well, and by the grace of God, when it came out, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And it's still pretty cool, but I've got the Leica 1600. And it turns out when you shoot a 30-06, the ballistic profile matches.
Oh, that's nice.
So I was very lucky there, and I would just dial right what my Leica told me. So, and I'd proved it out to range, and it had always been real accurate. So, you know, that kind of easy button to that. But now that I'm getting real flat shooting high speed cartridge with a slippery bullet, I'm probably going to have to go to a different system, because I don't have that easy button rangefinder. But yeah, so I'd been pretty fortunate that way.
So
yeah.
When's it going to be done?
Well, it's done now. I'm just waiting on Cerakote, but Drew's over at, he's at the Western Hunting Expo right now. So hopefully.
Freaking shows get in the way of hunting stuff.
I know. I was going to have this new whiz bang rifle, and I think it was actually Ryan that told him he had to go to it. So it's your fault that I don't have my rifle.
He said he followed my advice, and he just Ryan. Emailed me or texted me after we had talked, and I was like, oh, man.
You didn't know that was screwing Dione, did
you? Dione's going to have come hard at me. One thing I'll name, I'm doing a review on the Axial Precision rifle. I have a 300 Ultra. The one thing that appeals to me about Axial Precision, it's not, they're all-inclusive, basically. Outside of the barrel and the trigger, they're making everything, which I think is fantastic. I like those companies that think outside the box, and they're not just going with status quo. I'm not knocking like a Defiance Action, but they're not just buying an Action. They're building their own Actions to mm-hmm. their tolerances. They're making the changes that they think improve it, which I agree with most of their stuff, and their stock is awesome.
Yeah, and every bit of it's made to work together. So like even as simple as down to the firing pin, I spent hours talking with him, because I've actually been friends with Drew for quite a while and was involved in a lot of this. We spent hours talking about how all of those parts work together. You know, like the factory Remington 700 firing pin just rattles down a hole drilled in the bolt and it smashes into your primer.
Hopefully.
But, you know, even looking at tolerances and the surfaces and the shape that you put on the front end of your firing pin to make sure that thing is hitting the exact same point on your primer, making sure it's bushed to where it's tight tolerances. And then, you know, how heavy do you make your firing pin? You know, what is the optimal weight? Cause you want to have a fast lock time, mm-hmm. but you also don't want to make it so light that it doesn't have enough mass to ignite your primer. And then you've got to balance, okay, what's the perfect spring tension for that? So every single piece in this thing was intensely thought out.
I totally agree with that.
I have no doubts after meeting Drew that that's probably the truth.
You yeah. can tell he's perfectionist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mean he's one of those engineer type that you can't really talk to, but he's,
you can, I didn't think he was bad to talk to.
He's
some other engineers.
He's bad. Very much like talking to my son. They're
everything's matter of fact.
Yeah. They're matter of fact. I don't want to sound rude to Drew, but it's like, he's thinking on another level. Even when you're talking to him, he's probably rolling in the back of his brain about something else, and you can tell that.
Yeah. Well, what we had great luck with when we were going over a lot of this stuff, and we had to have some brain lube. We'd throw down some beers, and then we were talking the same language, and then we'd get a piece of paper out, and things were fluid. Yeah, Drew's a sharp dude.
You can tell. And I don't harp on this, but it's so much of the new fad of the custom hunting industry or rifle industry is buying other people's stuff. And I can't emphasize enough that I like these companies that are basically moving the bar to the next level. Mm-hmm. They're not just throwing 700 clones together for the sake of throwing 700 clones together, actually changing pieces on that action, that the negative comb on that stock.
Yeah.
That's amazing engineering. I mean, not Marvel so much as it's, why weren't we doing this for the last 20 years?
I know it takes no extra effort to make it that way. And it makes it kick so much less. You recoil straight back. It's so much more comfortable to shoot. You know, some of these things, it was a wonder why people weren't doing it. There are very few true one-piece bolts out there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's difficult to manufacture one, but Drew's hired process engineers and spent a ton of time thinking about it. And he's actually taught himself how to be a machinist. He wasn't a machinist before this. And he's figured out a way to effectively make a completely one-piece bolt. You know, his machine time is much lower than other people's. So he can make these parts better than other people, faster than other people, just by thinking it out more.
So their turnaround time for guns is a lot quicker.
Well, that's a big part of why he started doing a lot of it. Because, you know, when he entered into this venture, everything's 6-8 months out. Mm-hmm. How do you start a business when all your parts are 6-8 months out?
Yeah.
You got a guy calls you up, says, hey, I want to give you money for a gun right now. You're in the business of making and selling guns. Mm-hmm. And you have to tell him, sorry, I don't have the parts. Can you wait 8 months?
Yeah.
And nobody,
knowing people's attention span is not that long.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, well, it got to the point where that was acceptable. And I'm with Dione is, why is that acceptable?
Yeah. It's just because everybody had had such a crappy experience for so long that it became status quo. Mm-hmm. And that was the big driving force behind making stocks. I mean, there's other companies that make nice stocks, but Drew's thought was, well, I don't want to wait that long and I think I can do better. So he designed his own stock and they're awesome stocks.
No, they are. And man, we're just down at the sheep show and we looked at their new Mountain Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And that stock is just fits.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just nice pull, like the little palm swell. I like the way they cut out where your hand goes. And I don't have great big hands. So definitely some stocks just don't fit me.
If I remember right on that one, instead of having the palm swell be perfectly centered, I think that one might have a little bit
offset
of
and it's dug in a little more. So you can get your hand in closer to the stock.
You know, it's all those things that someone who's mostly concerned with just manufacturing a stock isn't going to take the time to try and make perfect, but the guy who's trying to make a perfect rifle is going to take the time to make that stock right.
Absolutely.
And for individual people, because I think a lot of people making even clothing and things like that, it's like if it doesn't apply to them, they don't see the bigger picture that it may apply to other people.
Yeah.
What their needs are.
People don't realize that so many of the things that you use from day to day that may even be the best in their class things, changes were made to those to make them easier to manufacture. If everything was built to be optimized, to be as good as it could possibly be, and not just because we need to be able to stamp this thing out effectively and cheaply, I think a lot of the things we use would look very different. You know, so that's the thing that Drew really discovered with building this rifle is so many compromises are made for manufacturing. So many compromises are made, and he wasn't willing to do that. So that's why everything's ground up.
And the crazy thing, he's not crazy with his price. He's right in the market.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's been in a fortunate position where he can have enough time on the front end before he starts trying to sell these things to get it right. You know, right. I think so many people, they start into a venture and they don't realize how much it's going to take to get something to where it's right. And it's like, well, this is what I've got. I need to start selling it. Mm-hmm. And that's where those compromises are made. You know, originally we were talking about buying bolts from someone else and then machining them because it seemed more economical to do that, to just buy other people's parts, make them fit our action or his action. And it got to the point where it's like, that's not right. That's not the best that can be done.
Yeah, you're 100% correct because they started 5 years ago and just started producing actual rifles 2 years ago. So they had 3 years in the process.
Yeah.
That says a lot about their commitment to quality
mm-hmm.
when they're willing to take 3 years to really perfect something instead of start getting, you know, getting stuff out on the shelf per se.
Yeah.
Because now everything has to start making money now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of cool that they went through the process of what worked, what didn't, how to change stuff a little bit to make it better.
Yeah.
And then came out with it. Novel concept.
It's like you said, he was able to do it and not a lot of people are able to do it. And it's going to show in the product in the end result.
Yeah.
So going into 2019 Mule Deer, now you have that baby.
Mm-hmm.
That baby.
Well, I know how hunters think they don't want to say that all the time, but you do have another time resource.
Yeah.
What's your plan? What's your goal?
I just have to be really focused and I have to be aware of the constraints I'm working under. You know, I've got limited time. I've got limited resources. If I just had a ton of money to throw at this, it'd be way easy. But I want to focus on doing one thing well. And that's the thing that I have to remind myself as I'm saying, oh, you know, it'd be pretty cool to go back to Colorado. There's a lot of deer there. You know, I've got some points building up. I could probably pull a tag in Utah or maybe I should go try and hunt Nevada. You know, there's a lot of distractions, but I think success comes to people who stay focused. And right now my best opportunity at success is to really just try and hammer down one thing well.
Does that include like one, I mean, when you say that, does that mean just one area or?
I doubt I'll even buy an elk tag this year.
Blasphemy.
I want to go out and kill one big buck.
You're going to buy two deer tags?
If I can, I'll buy two deer tags, but, you know, I'm really going to focus on killing that one big buck. And then if I get that done and there's time left, I'll go hunt another one. But,
that Ruma asked me a question. I wanted to ask you a question about this and I forgot till you said that. What's your thought process on these guys buying two tags and popping a two or three point and then think, oh, no, I'm going to hunt a big buck.
I think they're wasting their time.
I would agree.
I think most people aren't good enough to kill one big deer, let alone two. And it's not that they don't have all of the skills necessary. It's that they lack the patience and perseverance. And it's so easy to get distracted and to be like, okay, well, the hunt's kind of sucking right now. There's this deer. I'm going to shoot that thing and I'll have a meat buck. You know, if you're hunting for meat, there's nothing wrong with that at all. I don't have anything against people doing that. But if your goal is to kill a big buck, you just wasted days on the mountain. And drawing from personal experience, I had a hunt a few years ago and ended up running into a guy a whole bunch on the mountain. We decided to just hunt together. And I was getting pretty frustrated. And found this deer. I'm like, I'm going to shoot that deer 130 yards away. He popped up. I shot him. He hit the dirt 10 yards to the side of him. 180 inch buck jumped up. That guy shot that buck.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I learned hard lessons like that where it's like, okay, you know, you think you know everything that's on the mountain, but as soon as that gun goes off, there's always animals you weren't expecting. So if that's your primary area and that's where you're planning on hunting, that's the place that you've scouted out, you might have just hosed yourself. And looking back even to 2015, that big wide buck that's my profile picture, that deer, I'd scouted that area for 6 weeks and I'd never once seen that deer. I'd seen other nice bucks, and if I'd have shot one of them, I wouldn't have killed that other deer.
So you said when you start out, your goal is 170 or bust.
Yeah, and you know, in a year like this one where I'm only doing one thing, or I'm planning on only doing one hunt, and I might stretch that a bit higher just because they're rare. I mean, a true on the ground, put an actual tape measure on a 170 inch deer is incredibly rare. And I think people lose sight of that with Instagram and all the other, you know, social media sources out there where you see these giant bucks all the time. It's just like, that's not reality. And most of these people, or not most, but quite a few of these people that you're seeing a lot of big deer on, well, they're getting them in places where you can't hunt. Like, you know, there's a lot of landowner tags. There's a lot of draw tags and it's not repeatable. Like I think for a person to go in and be able to consistently find 170 inch deer, you're doing significantly better than most.
On public land. Yeah. And I think that I don't care where you kill deer. It's America. Capitalism should rule the day, but you should tell the truth. You know, you should say when asked, cause people, well, there's people shooting these ginormous elk that are these celebrities, but they ain't hunting the same elk me and you are hunting.
No, they're hunting the hill ranch. Yeah. They're hunting wherever. Yeah.
Well, and they should make that. You shouldn't have to ask. They should make that, you know, very apparent when they're posting it up on social media. Like, this is where I shot it.
Because right.
It does. It's super frustrating to the people, the new people.
Well, it sets unreal expectations.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not anti draw tag. I'm not anti landowner tag. I'm not anti any of that stuff. I take a lot of pride in knowing that most of the animals I kill, anybody could have walked into a store, bought a tag, and had the same opportunity I did.
It puts a level playing field.
Yeah.
Is how I see it. Is it everything that you have an opportunity at, anybody else has an opportunity at.
So I went on a New Mexico elk tag that I was invited on Indian reservation. Those ain't the same deer I'm hunting in North Idaho.
Yeah.
Or sorry, same elk. I shot a 350 plus inch bull on that Indian reservation. But in my mind, I can't say that it was like I cheated it, but I would have more love for a 300 inch bull in North Idaho than I have for that elk, which I'm excited about that elk, but it's not the same playing field. And I've said from day one that I shot that on Indian reservation.
Yeah.
But
and, you know, the other thing, we're not all gifted with the God given talent that Robbie Denning has. We're not all legends.
We're not all legends.
Yeah. We can't just go to a unit that's never produced a 180 inch buck and find one magically.
From the recesses of, you know, wherever they come from.
That said, I do think it's important not to try to measure yourself against what anybody else is doing, and you got to go out and set your goals. I've been fortunate and had good success in the past, and for me that means I want to try and shoot bigger than 170 inch deer. But like I said, most deer don't get that big, at least in central Idaho. You know, across a lot of the areas I've hunted and most of the areas I've been, your average deer isn't going to get over that. So, you know, appreciate whatever it is you got. You know, set a goal, go out and try and achieve it.
Yeah, that's what I like. You set a goal and you're like the working man, mule deer assassin.
I try to be.
Yeah.
I aspire to be.
That's going to be your new name.
Well, we are at an hour and we appreciate your time, Deone. You can find Deone on Instagram at Wild Idaho. Is it Wild _ Idaho?
I think it's _.
Yeah, he's a very entertaining Instagrammer.
I don't take much seriously. And I try and cater my humor to about 3% of the audience. So if you don't, if you don't get it, you're not alone.
And why I like Deone is that's my kind of humor. Right. So, I agree. Well, thanks for coming on,
yeah,
Deone.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.